Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker. Spelt Cooker, pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Today's podcast is another special.
Woohoo!
Yes, I'm having a conversation with Jasmine Sawyer. Jasmine Sawyer is our long jumper, Team GB long jumper.
Ours?
Ours, yeah, we own her. She's British. She's just a really interesting person. She's also a singer and she does some presenting. Fascinating conversation with her. Basically, we cover so much ground with her and she answers everything. Interesting woman, isn't she?
Really brilliant.
She was great. Okay, well, let's meet her. This is Jasmine Sawyer.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Jasmine, thank you for coming today. Welcome to my kitchen. I bought you a present. I buy everyone a present. And I know you like reading books.
I do.
And this is one of my favourite books. I thought this is something that you could... It's Haman Suman. He's... I've met him a couple of times, actually. He's a monk from South Korea. And this is just a beautiful book with lots of lovely things about life and everything. I thought as you're traveling around the world competing, you could take it
Thank
with you.
Thank you so much.
It's all right.
I'm going to enjoy that. Thank
well,
you.
Well, let me know what you think about it.
I
love it. Every time I'm feeling slightly down, I pick up that book and it lifts me up. So, yeah.
It's oh, it really looks like my kind of book as well. This is.
Oh, you like reading, don't you?
Yeah, I love it.
We'll talk to you about your favourite book later. But I suppose you have a lot of time where you're doing nothing.
Yeah, a lot of downtime. It's kind of, you know, I think a lot of people assume if you're training for the Olympics, you're training all day. But it's long jump. I run for 35 meters. You can't. If I train all day, I'll just be too tired to do that quickly and well. So there's a lot of downtime.
Off the back of the last Olympics, we had loads of Olympians on the show. And the two things that became real, well, I just found fascinating was the amount of time the coaches are now stressing you have to rest.
Yeah.
Sleep. Rest. They want you to sleep more than 8 hours, don't they? They want you to just
constantly... Oh yeah, so I consider sleep my secret weapon.
Right.
My personal best came from my best week of sleep according to my watch and things, and just the amount I'd slept and the amount of deep sleep I'd had. That's the best week I've ever recorded, and then I jumped my best first ever.
And the other thing that I learned was that if you want to date an athlete, it's really boring.
So boring because
you're not allowed to do anything
No.
apart from train and rest. But fortunately, your boyfriend's an athlete too.
Also so that works out.
So you can just do that the same.
Just train and then both do absolutely nothing together. So that's nice.
All right, you better give us a little plotted history of you. So how you actually ended up being a long jumper.
Yeah, so I've done sport competitively since I was about 5. I started out in gymnastics. Did that until I was sort of 10, 11, tried athletics at school, loved it. Gymnastics was good, but I don't think I was ever going to be international level, and that's all I wanted. After watching the Olympics, age 6, so it would have been Sydney, I just thought, right, I want to be there. I wasn't, at that point, I thought it would be gymnastics, but I wasn't that fussed what. I remember watching the heptathlon, so Denise Lewis win gold, thought that looks kind of fun too. Hadn't tried athletics at that point. Started to try it at school and thought, no, this is the one I want to do. And also it helped that I'd been to the age group nationals in gymnastics and come next to last. So I was like, all right, this isn't happening. At gymnastics, you need to know by a young age that you're going to be good. So I was looking for the next thing. Begged my parents to let me swap to athletics, did that, and then initially moved into heptathlon because it's just, as a kid, I think a lot of people start with multi-events. You can just try loads and loads of things.
What are the events in that, remind
us? Heptathlon is 100-meter hurdles, high jump, shot put, 200 meters, long jump, javelin, 800 meters.
Wow. Which ones were you good at?
I was only good at the jumps and the sprints. So my 800 meters and my throws were terrible, like really, really bad. So I'd, you know, day one is... hurdles, high jump, shot put, 200. That was kind of fine. Kind of got away with that. Day two, I'd do the long jump and I'd be in first. And I'd be like, great, I'm going to win this thing. Javelin had come. Oh, I'm eighth. 800 had come, I'm 21st. So, you know, it made sense that I did end up moving to the long jump, but it wasn't quite that simple. I did heptathlon until I was 17. I went to the World Youth Championships for that, came ninth, and thought, all right, I don't like ninth. Eight whole people beat me. That's far too many. And then that winter started doing bobsleigh, which didn't seem like an obvious thing, but the skills for bobsleigh and the training, it's a lot to do with speed and power. And British Bobsleigh came to my school and said, look, we're looking for athletes for the Youth Olympics. We've got drivers. We need brake women and brake men. The tests are standing long jump and 30 meter sprints. And I was like, well, that's what I do. I do that anyway. Made that team and spent the next two winters when I was sort of doing my A-levels, I say sort of because I was only half there, away sliding and competing. So did that for 2 years.
We've just got to reverse there. What's a brake man woman?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay, so bobsleigh, there's now three. There's monobob, where it's just one person that does everything, which is the driving, the pushing, the pulling the brakes. There's two man or two woman, which you have a driver and a brake man woman, someone that pulls the brakes. I mean, the role of the brakeman, I think some people think you brake around the corners. You absolutely do not brake around the corners. You'll get fined. You push at the start, so you have to be strong and fast. You get in, you hang on for dear life and hope that your driver is competent. And then if you reach the end, still on all four runners, you pull the brakes right at the end.
So your job is just to pull the brakes at the end?
Yep. And to push at the start, you have to be fast.
And then then the rest of it, you just put your life in the hands of someone driving it.
Exactly. In a two-man sled, so you're folded over, you're folded completely in half. And all you can see as the brakeman is the little rectangle of space where you can see the ice rushing underneath you, because that's where the brake pulls up. It's just a big claw that just hacks into the ice. And you spend the whole time, you learn the course the same as the driver does, so you can feel the corners and you can feel if you're in the wrong place. So you know if you're too high on a corner and you're about to crash. So you're just there hanging on to sort of the inside of the sled.
But how do you get to trust that person driving you?
I think you going through a crash with them is one thing, to realize it's not that bad. I spent my first week doing bobsleigh just crashing. I think I had to go down a track 7 times before I didn't crash, because we were kids. We were 16 learning.
So it's not that bad, but in the Winter Olympics, a couple of Winter Olympics, someone died just before the
luge.
Events.
That was in the luge. So it was, luge is more dangerous than bobsleigh.
Right.
You're on your back on the luge and it's either one or two people and you're kind
still fast and ice is hard.
It's still fast and dangerous. I mean, we were out.
You're wearing a crash helmet for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're training, when you're first learning, you have big shoulder pads and Kevlar vests and all sorts to stop the ice burns. And there was a time when we'd gone down and I was waiting in the sled behind. Someone had just gone off and everything got halted because somebody had broken their back.
Oh, no.
So it can be bad, but every crash I've been in about 10 crashes and it's just cuts and bruises.
How did your parents?
I was just about to say, Mum didn't love it. I remember my first week of bobsleigh, I sent her a picture of all my bruises and was like, ha-ha, Mum, look at this. And she said, I really don't want to look at that. Don't show me. And they were insistent that they weren't going to come and watch me do it because they didn't want to see a crash. But when they came, they did come to we competed at the Youth Olympics, won a silver medal. Me and Misha McNeil, who's still doing bobsleigh, she's now the GB number one pilot for bobsleigh. They came and they loved it. It's exciting. It is. And I mean, I think most people watch bobsleigh hoping to see a crash. Not my parents. They didn't want to see me crash, but they did end up really enjoying it.
Right. You medaled, though, didn't you?
Yeah, we got a silver medal.
And isn't there's a fact like you're the only people ever to do that at the Youth Olympics or something. Is that true or something, or was?
We were the first, because that was the first Winter Youth Olympics.
Okay.
And so we were the only medalists from that Games. And we were one of the very last events of the whole thing. So I think the general feeling in the team was a little bit of disappointment because nobody had managed to win a medal. And then it came around to the bobsleigh and we got one.
And so why'd you give up?
I want to go back.
Well, you do?
Yeah, I want to go back. I basically stopped because I thought, okay, I need to pick one. I was still doing athletics at this point.
Okay.
So in the summer, I was training for heptathlon, and then I'd swap in the winter and come and do bobsleigh. And I thought, okay, this isn't sustainable. You have to gain a load of weight for bobsleigh, which is the most fun ever. I love it. But then I have to drop it again in the summer to try and compete in athletics. And it was just so unsustainable.
Why'd you have to gain weight to get down quicker?
Yeah, basically, there's a weight limit, but the weight limit includes the people and the sled. So if you can be heavier and the sled can be lighter, obviously it's better for heavy, strong people to be pushing a light sled than small people to add weight into the sled and have to push that.
Right.
So we were one of the smallest teams when we competed at Youth Olympics. We were one of the lightest teams. We had to add weight to our sled because obviously you're going downhill. You want to hit the maximum weight limit because it's gravity. So you want the overall sled to be as heavy as it can be, but we were light. So we became the smaller people having to push a heavier sled. So we'd constantly be encouraged to gain weight.
So how much would you have to gain?
So I think when I moved from heptathlon into bobsleigh in 2012, I gained 7 or 8 kilos and I was only 17. So that was quite
a lot.
That was quite a lot. And then I had to lose it again for the summer.
How did you feel about that?
At the time, it was sort of just it was a fun challenge.
Right.
And it was kind of like, okay, I mean, gaining weight was much more fun. I enjoyed that bit. I enjoyed when they tell me, all right, no, you're still not heavy enough. Go on, gain some more. All right, guess I'm off to McDonald's.
So how did you end up doing long jump then?
So 2012, we won the silver medal in the bobsleigh.
Yeah.
And I'd spent all winter focused on that. And normally in the winter for heptathlon, you spend it all building your endurance, building your strength, which I had been building my strength, and fine-tuning your skills. So obviously I was terrible at throws, terrible at 800. I had no endurance because I'd just been doing bobsleigh where you run for 30 meters and jump in. I had a lot of strength, but I'd just not been working on any of my skills. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to be prepared this summer. I'm not going to make the team for the World Juniors in the heptathlon. Like, it's just not reasonable because I haven't been training for it. I've been training for bobsleigh. And I thought, okay, what's the closest thing to bobsleigh in the heptathlon? And it was long jump. It was you run for 30 meters and you jump in. And I thought, okay, there's a little bit of difference. I'm not on the ice and I'm not pushing a big thing, but a lot of the training is the same. You do a lot of sprint training. You do fast, heavy lifting, Olympic lifts. And I thought, okay, if I can sort of lose the weight I've gained for bobsleigh and translate these skills over, I've been fast all winter, whereas normally you spend it building endurance and you have to rebuild the speed. And I thought, I've already got the speed. I've been working on that. If I can drop the weight, this should make sense. And long jump was one of my stronger events anyway. And so the year before, I said I'd come 9th in the World Youths. I swapped to long jump, ideally just for the year. I was planning on going back to heptathlon. But then I went to the World Juniors a year too young and came 3rd. I thought, okay, well, I've managed to win a medal in this event. I was top of the age group last year in the heptathlon and came 9th. Maybe I'm just better at this. And if I do this, I don't have to run the 800. So I thought, that's it. I'm going to stick with the long jump.
But what's the drive for you? The drive is just winning medals at anything, at all costs.
Yeah, I want to win.
Is that a...
Yeah, I just want to win. I want to be the best. I love competing, but I only really love competing when I'm doing well, which I think is natural. I do love winning, but I really hate losing.
I've got a bit of a problem with this though,
because
we hear this all the time. All the commentators that love to go, oh, they're a great sportsman. They love winning. They hate losing. And it sort of implies that the rest of the world who aren't involved in athletics or sport of any description really like losing. And I imagine most humans go, I hate the feeling of losing.
Yeah.
And I think I have a real problem with losing. Mm-hmm. Really bad. Really bad. Mark's nodding his head there. And I really like winning, like yourself. But I've sort of come to this conclusion in my older age that actually the better you are at losing, the more successful you are. I think that's how to visualize life, whereas we're told that's completely the opposite way around. And I'm starting to think I've got it wrong all my life.
That's interesting. I've never heard it put like that. I don't know whether... I'm really not good at losing. So, I'm awful. Sometimes I have to fully take myself off away from everybody because I know I'm going to be horrible. My mum won't even talk to me when I've lost because she knows there's no point.
Yeah.
Because there's no point trying to tell me I've done well when I haven't, because I'll just come back with some horrible response. I know I haven't done well and I don't want to hear that I have. You know, people try and make you feel better. That really, you know, you did. It was good. It was
great.
Yeah,
but did you try your hardest?
Yeah, but
so
I still didn't win.
Yeah, but that's all you can do.
It is all you can do.
It's impossible to do better than try your hardest.
True, but then it feels even worse. You're like, I did everything I could and I still lost.
Yeah.
Wow. I think what it is with...
But you have to accept that, surely, and then go... And you did that. I listened to a talk you did, a TED talk you did on actually losing to win or something. What was it called?
Quitting to win.
Quitting to win, which I found fascinating. And so you do understand the concept then of it didn't work, but it's not necessarily my fault. I need to change. Can you just explain the concept of your TED talk?
So the talk was sometimes you have to quit to win. That was the title of it. And you know, you hear the whole winners never quit, quits never win. And I just don't think that's true. Sometimes you have to know when to quit a certain element of what you're doing in order to ultimately win. And I talked a lot in that talk about leaving coaches rather than pushing through where I was, moving and, you know, quote unquote quitting so that I could actually eventually win, or to let go of something that's not for you in order to win somewhere else.
What I took from it, and I don't know whether this is what you were trying to get across, is your happiness is more imperative in your performance to 100%. Get a good performance than just suffering constantly.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, there's been times where physically I've done all the training and I know that I'm in shape to compete well, but I haven't been happy in my situation and I just can't. The results don't come.
That you're completely opposed to. I'll use Nike because you're sponsored by Adidas. You're completely opposed to the Nike thing, which is suffer as much as possible. If you're not suffering, their ethos, all those brands, sports brands. If the reason why they're brilliant is because they suffer more than you is what they're saying. Yeah, the reality is Olympians these days. You're pushing your bodies to the actual limit, but you're doing a lot of resting, and you got.
Yeah, it's not that miserable, and you know if. I also used to believe that. I looked at it and I thought, that's how you do it. You just work the hardest. You make yourself the most miserable. You give up as much as you possibly can and you'll be rewarded. But when I look at people around me who are successful, who have those gold medals, that's not actually the case. They have put themselves in their best possible position. Yeah, it's hard. But it's not hard to the point where you are sad about it, where you are miserable. It's just really, really difficult. I think, you know, there's the whole, do I love winning? Do I hate losing? It's more, I like winning more than I like doing, I like going out at night. It's that. It's, there's been situations where I've been training where the training is good and there's no way to get around that. I know full well that this has worked for other people, but I've got no friends where I am, or I don't get on too well with the coach. And it's that kind of drag on life, I think, when I've been upset, when I've been not been able to be myself and be happy, that for some reason my body goes, no, we're not going to give you, I know you've worked for it, I know you've put in the hours in the gym, put the hours in on the track, but we're not, come the day of competition, we're not doing it.
Why?
I don't know, but for some reason that is a formula for me. If I'm not happy, my body won't give me the performance that I'm asking for. It won't do it.
I think Haemin Sunim's going to help you, the Buddhist Buddhist monk from South Korea. He'll say some wise things on that. Let's talk about your training then, because you know it's really hard for us to envisage what you have to do, because literally you just run for 35 minutes, you say, and you jump. So there's obviously two types of training. There's one which is to get you stronger to power off, and there's another one with technique to get you to fly in the air more. And let's talk about the technique first, because it just seems such a strange concept that you can get. Because I've been following you quite a long time on social media, and you sort of talk about just phases or something. You talk about and you just need to change something in the phase to get another whatever it is, point something of a centimeter. But we can't comprehend that. What is actually happening during that jump process?
So there's so many tiny, tiny things that you could make sort of half a degree of difference at the angle you take off, and that could make 30 centimeters of difference at the other end.
Right.
And I think that's what sometimes doesn't make sense. You'll say, I'll show somebody two videos and they'll go, they're exactly the same. And I'll go, no, look at my left arm in that one.
Right.
And my left arm could be, instead of being directly above me, it moves forward quarter of a second too quickly, and you'll see that throws off the whole jump. It's tiny, tiny, tiny little things, and you can get obsessed with it and you can overcomplicate it. But ultimately with long jump, what tends to happen at the elite level, because everybody knows how to jump, it will be the fastest person at the board will generally win, because it's physics. It's you're carrying the most momentum. If you can take off faster than anybody else and the angle is good, it just makes sense that you're going to go further than anybody.
Do you spend a lot of time on video analysis?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because sometimes you just can't catch it. And a lot of the time, what I think is good is not good. It's just what I'm used to. So my coach will say, how did that feel? And I'd be like, amazing. He was like, well, it was awful.
That's nice.
He's like, and here's why. And I'll show you the video. I can't understand until I've seen it.
Right. So do you have to, so you spend a lot of time working on speed?
Yes, a lot of time working on speed. That's why I moved to the coach that I'm currently at. He's basically a sprints coach.
Can you do 100 meters, or you can 35 meters?
So I want to do 100. My 100 meter time is slow. I think it's about 12.7, my personal best, which is not good. I shouldn't, if that truly is my speed, I shouldn't be able to jump as far as I can jump. I should be faster than that. But my coach won't let me do a 100 meter race yet. I think he wants to wait until I'm actually a legitimately good 100 meter runner before he puts his name to that.
Right. Okay.
But I really want to do one to see how fast I would be now.
Okay, so you think you've gained speed?
Yes, I've definitely gained speed from then.
Okay, and then you say it's only about speed, but when you hit that board, surely there must be something in your muscles which spring you forward. Is that not the case?
Yeah, I suppose there must be, but I don't know if that's something that's always, maybe from my gymnastics days, that's always been there. So I've never had to think about that.
Right.
It's always been about how fast are you taking off and where is your foot in comparison to your hips on the board?
Okay.
So if I stick my foot out in front of me, it acts as a brake and it sends me flying straight up in the air, which looks amazing. Looks so impressive. When I do those kind of jumps in competition, you hear the crowd go, ooh, and I'm like, don't ooh, that's not going to be very far. But it looks good because I'm short and you see me flying high up in the air. Great. Not great. Really what I want is a slightly flatter jump with my foot at takeoff as close to underneath me as I can get it, because that it's like I'm carrying on running. The technique is sort of, as it's called, a hitch kick. I keep running through the air. Obviously it has to alter slightly, otherwise I would keep running. I have to alter the angle very, very slightly so that I can take off, but as close as I can get it to beneath me means that my momentum will drive forward instead of up.
And why can't you do it perfectly every time?
Oh, I wish I knew. That's the dream. That's what I go to training for every day. I don't know. At the minute, I'm getting like one in every six, which is so frustrating.
How many jumps are you allowed in a competition?
So everybody gets three. I mean, they've started messing with the rules, which we'll come to, but everybody gets three. And then the top eight, they reverse the order. So the person in eighth goes first and then they get three more.
Right.
But they've started messing with it. Recently, we had one competition where everybody gets three. The top eight get two more. And then the top three get one more jump. It's wiped clean. It's like sudden death. Whoever wins the third round wins. The sixth round wins altogether, which makes no sense because we all fouled. Then what?
Yeah. Such a mindfuck, isn't it? Because you know how good you can be. Yet if you don't do that jump, it's not like a sort of 800 meters or something. You can try. I need to go faster now, otherwise I'm not going to win. You literally have to start every time going, please let this jump be the one.
Yeah. And one jump can be enough, you know, without those stupid new rules. Somebody could jump really well in round one and have five fouls and still win, which has happened.
Okay, so a foul is going over the board.
Yeah, it's
so
going over the plasticine.
By the way, you're left-handed, right?
Yeah.
Are you left-footed to jump?
No, I take off on my right foot.
Okay.
But I'm only left-handed for writing. I throw with my right hand.
You throw with your right? Yeah. Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, I know.
Why is all this then? Why is that?
I have no idea. I can't figure it out. Never known. I write with my left. I can write with my right. I used to swap during exams and homework, and I had teachers come back to me going, somebody else did this half. And I goes, no, my hand got tired. My right hand's not great at writing. I prefer to write with my left, but I've always thrown with the right. No idea why.
Okay. But so do you do one easy jump where you make sure you hit the board?
No, I don't, unless it comes to the third round and I've had two fouls. So I had to do that recently, British Championships. Round one, foul. Round two, foul. Round three, I moved way back, slowed right down, and just did a safe one to get me into the fourth round. But I can afford to do that at the British Champs because a worse jump of mine can still make the top eight. At the World Champs, I can't do that. If I do a bad jump, that's not going to make the top eight. I need to jump well in rounds one to three. So that's something I'm working on, is being able to bring what I need in the early rounds, because I seem to not be able to do anything without pressure, which is very frustrating.
Right, okay. I'm a bit stupid here, but clearly the speed is going to be similar every time. The run-up's going to be similar. Mm-hmm. Why are you going to go over the board?
So it can be something as simple as my first few strides, I pushed out slightly harder on one. It could be this technical point. So how I said I'm trying to get my foot directly underneath me?
Yeah.
If I slip on that and don't do that well, my foot will drift out in front. And it can drift out in front by a centimeter, and that can be a foul. So if I don't technically execute, my run-up is set up so that when I technically execute well, I hit the board legally. So if I start to drift ever so slightly, if I don't do everything technically perfectly, I'll start. My bad habit is to drift my foot out in front and do that breaking sensation, and that'll take me over the board. But I don't want to move my run up back, because then if I do it right, I won't even be on the board.
Oh my God, there's so much going on.
Yeah, it's just run and jump, but it's not.
If you ever play golf, because if you're trying to play golf and you're trying to get better, suddenly you've got all these things going through your mind constantly, and you've got to forget it, otherwise you can't hit the ball. So it's like, you know, do this, take the ball, but keep your eye on the ball, and you know, swing through and all that sort of stuff. And I suppose that must be similar to you. In between every jump, do you do you analyse the hell out of the next jump?
Yeah, so you'll see the athletes go straight to their coach. The coach will make some sort of wild hand gestures. We understand it all. And they'll tell you what you did wrong, what you need to do better. I try and ask for only one or two things because it's too much to process. And if you're thinking on the runway, you're slowing down. And that always happens. So what I'll do, I have a whole process where I'll visualise the jump. As soon as my coach has told me what to do, I'll visualise doing it right. Then I'll go away and sit, relax, because usually it's going to be sort of 10-15 minutes between rounds.
Yeah. What do you do in between those?
Chat to the others, but stretch, do a little jog.
Right, do you have to warm up before every jump?
So you need to make sure you're still warm.
Right,
yeah.
So how long does a warm up take?
So a full warm up
is
anything between 50 minutes and an hour and a half.
And then you have to maintain warm throughout the whole. But that's, how can you do that?
You bring a lot of clothes with you, put them on, and then you make sure that in between rounds you do a little jog, you do some drills. You kind of just got to stay as warm as you can. Obviously, depending on where you are. If you're in Birmingham in...
Surely it'd be better to let you do three jumps in a row.
No, you'd be too tired. Because you're absolutely...
Tired? You're only running 39 meters, well, Jesus Christ. No wonder you were crap at the 800 meters.
I'll bring you to a training session. I'll have you go flat out, take off, and put about 12 times your body weight through your takeoff leg. When you take off.
How are your knees?
And do it awful. Didn't do it immediately twice again. And you'll see what I mean. It's more tiring than you'd think.
Does it hurt landing?
Landing doesn't hurt. Takeoff hurts.
Well, it looks like a sand thing. Because it looks like you crunch your legs when you go in. Because you're stretching your legs as far as possible.
Yeah, you stretch your legs out as far as possible. Then you try and curl yourself into the hole that your feet have already made. So that you don't make a mark in the sand behind you. Landing's never really hurt me. Everybody has their own way of landing.
Yeah.
And I've kind of gotten used to it now.
You're right. Yeah. So how far do you jump then? When you're in the air, how far are you going?
So my furthest ever is 6.86 meters.
What does that feel like?
As soon as you've taken off, you know.
What does it feel like though? Does it go in slow motion?
No, absolutely not. I can barely remember them.
Do you not feel like you're flying?
No.
You don't?
The only time I feel like I'm flying is when we do training off a box so that... It's weird how this works. You can elevate yourself off the ground 5 centimeters. You can have a 5 centimeter box that's got a track surface on top. Take off on that and all of a sudden you've got all the height in the world. And that's how you learn new techniques because you've got more time in the air.
Oh, amazing.
But in competition, no. Because you're trying to process so many things, obviously I said you don't think too hard. You've still got to try and make sure your landing's good. It's gone in an instant.
All right, with all that stuff going on, why the hell do long jumpers and triple jumpers always have to do the bloody clapping hands crap with the audience, with the crowd? Surely,
I love it.
Yeah, but surely that's just an added thing. You got, you know...
But
when
that just
you're
gets you hyped up. And I think it makes you run... Well, it makes me run faster.
Where was the last competition where there was no crowds? Where was that? Where Doha. Were you? Doha, yeah.
Yeah.
Was that like just two people clapping?
It's embarrassing to start a clap when nobody's there. So I tried to avoid it. It's weird when no one's there. But no, I've always loved it.
So not pressure, you start doing the clapping thing and they don't join in. Like, nah, don't fancy that. Do you all do it? Does every single...
No, some people don't like it. Some people ask for quiet. If you're a big enough name and everybody's watching in the stadium, if you sort of put your hand to your lips and say quiet, everyone will just go dead silent. So I don't like that. I much prefer big noise to feel like everybody in the stadium is supporting me.
But I always think when you're doing the clapping thing, right, because you've seen them do it throughout the time, I always think the clapping suddenly, because it keeps on going faster and faster, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And then I think it must just ruin the run-up because they're clapping out of time for the way you're running, or you're not thinking about it.
You're just not thinking about it. All I'm hearing is noise, and that noise feels like support. So I'm still counting. If I don't count, it will ruin my running.
Right. Okay.
But I'm still counting my strides, so I'm going 2, 4, 2, 4, 6, 2, 4, 6, 8. So I count every other step, because if you count each one, you just can't count fast enough. If I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, that's just too many. My feet are moving quicker than I can say the words in
my head. Why are you counting the strides?
Because each bit of the run-up has a different purpose. So I count 2, 4, which is my drive-out phase, and then I start to stand up, and I count 2, 4 for that section, and then I speed up for 6, 2, 4, 6. And then,
so crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's mad. It's mad for someone like me to hear this, because you just think you're running as fast as you can down the thing, but clearly you've got different phases of the run-up as well.
Yeah, each sort of section of the run-up has a different purpose. So I have a mark on the track 12 meters out from the board, which is one for my coach to see if I'm going to hit it, and he'll know if I'm going to hit the board and whether or not I was stretching for the board. Because if I hit that mark, I should hit the board bang on. And two, it's for me to subconsciously see and go, it's time to speed up.
Okay. Talk about fine margins. I'm always fascinated by what the athletes choose to wear. And also the fact that you've cut your hair off. Do you think that is that to go further? Do you think, or you're growing it back now? But you shaved it all off. You had long hair, didn't you, for a while?
And yeah, then, I had really long hair. Yeah. And then, but I'd love to say it was a performance decision. I did it because I wanted to be more aerodynamic. I did it because I was lazy. I had braids in, and they were taking so long to take out. We'd already been going at it for 2 hours, and I said, "Mum, I'm just going to cut it off." And she goes, "Are you sure? Like, this is a big decision. Are you sure you want to do that?" So I took the braid front and center in my forehead and snipped it with a pair of scissors. And goes, "Well, we have to now."
Wow.
It was very much a...
Does it make a difference? Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Did it make a difference?
No. Honestly, no.
You don't think that?
I don't think so. I haven't noticed a difference. I mean...
But surely it must aerodynamically.
But then when I had long hair, I used to braid it down anyway.
Right.
So I'd braid it down and it wasn't flying around. I'd have two sort of French plaits and tuck it in so that it was aerodynamic anyway. I do see some people with big long braids and I think they're really heavy. How can you compete with those? I don't understand how people can high jump, for example. Nafi Tiam, the heptathlon Olympic champion, high jumps with these big braids and can high jump over 2 meters. I don't know how she can do it. I can barely run in braids.
I suppose if you feel good, though, and you think you look good.
That makes a huge difference. What it has done for me, if I feel like I look good, then that just brings a different level of confidence. Because I think when you first start out doing the big competitions, having that many cameras on, you're not used to it. And so you do start to feel self-conscious about what you actually look like. So if you can walk out there feeling good, knowing that there's cameras everywhere all over you, and you think, well, don't worry about, yeah, take my picture.
Yeah.
I look great. So it genuinely helps.
Interesting time, isn't it, in women's sport, I think. I was thinking about this earlier. Athletics for women is really hit equality with men quite a long time ago. Don't you think? It's one of the sports which is... I think I know more female athletes than I do men now. And you've been on par for quite a long time.
We have. And I think that's come from the fact that you don't get to watch men's athletics. You just watch athletics. You don't have a choice.
Brilliant.
You can't decide whether or not you watch the women. They're there as well.
Very true.
You know, if you go to an athletics event, there's women running the 100 meters and there's men doing the discus. We're all there. You don't have to choose to watch women's sport. You just watch the sport. I think it's similar with gymnastics. Often you have the men and women going at the same time in the same arena. And so you're just watching the sport. You don't have to go to a separate event. You don't have to decide that you're a fan of women's athletics. There is no... People don't talk about women's athletics. It's just athletics.
Yeah, it is. That's true.
Whereas with the team sports, obviously you can't do that. You go to watch a game. So I think women's sport has to grow on its own because...
So what's it like being a competitor then? Does it feel like you're very... equal with each other, as in you don't see yourself as I know you're in the women's category, but you just see yourself as a big team of men and women.
It does feel like that. It really feels like that because we're on the same team as well. You know, you pick an athletics team and you see the big list and it's the men and the women there together. You don't pick a men's team and pick a women's team separately. It's one sport and it's never felt anything different to that to me.
Does it feel the women are dominating in our team GB?
Yeah.
It feels that way for a while.
Yeah, but the women are the ones winning the medals.
Yeah.
You know, it's the women that are the big stars at the moment in the sport. But, you know, that's not something that I deliberately notice because we're in one sport.
Yeah, I didn't notice it.
It just feels like it's going well.
I was watching you do an interview with Dean Ash Smith the other day and you're best mates, aren't you? You're very, very close. And it suddenly occurred to me that, hold on a second, these guys are the people that I know, they're the, and that's when it sort of occurred to me.
Yeah.
Are you very supportive of each other when she was in Doha and stuff?
Massively. It's been amazing to kind of grow up with her in the sport. And it's inspiring to us to see your friends doing things that this is my dream too. But, you know, we can all have it, which is very nice. You know, my closest friends are in different events to me. And that's the beauty with athletics. There are so many events that you can have so many of your friends that are not your direct competition, but you're still in the same sport. Watching Dina grow into what she's become, she's a superstar.
She's incredible.
She's amazing. And, you know, we've been... The last time I ran a relay, actually, not the last time, one of the very last times I ran a relay was at the Youth Commonwealth Games. And we won gold. And Dina was in the relay team with me. So okay, there's
amazing.
There was four of us that we'd won our individual events, and then we all came together for the relay and we won the relay. And, you know, so then I felt like, yeah, me and Dina are the same. We're coming through this sport together. Now, obviously, she's progressed much further than me at this point. But I look at her and I go, well, we're the same. So I can definitely do that because that's what you're doing. It just makes sense to me. And it's I'm so happy for her. I want to, obviously I want the same thing, but to see somebody that you've come through the years with.
Yeah, because obviously, is there any, oh, I don't want to ask this, I'm going to, is there any sort of jealousy because she's actually, I mean, God, that last tournament was amazing, wasn't it? Oh. I mean, she was, wow, incredible.
Big wow.
Yeah, and Katrina Johnson-Thompson, she's doing really well as well. I mean, is there any jealousy on your behalf because you want the gold?
You know what, a little bit.
Yeah.
To start with, you look and you go, oh, that's, I didn't do well in Doha. I had bad championships, and I looked, and by the time I even went to compete, Dina already had one medal. And I thought, oh, wish that was me. But that's just one part of it. That very quickly dies down when I realise, yeah, but it's Dina. Yeah, but that's your mate. That's,
right.
Oh okay. My God, like Dina's got a medal. So there's a part of me that goes, I don't have a medal. But the part that says Dina has one is so much bigger than that because it's just so exciting for my friend to be achieving her dreams, you know?
Do you worry about, I can ask you this question because I've seen you interviewed a lot and you've got a good brain on you. Do you worry about it defining you that when you, because eventually it's going to all end.
Yeah.
And someone like Dina, I mean, she's like, you know, on top of the world at the moment. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you are one day going to get slower. You're one day not going to be able to jump as fast.
Yeah.
And are you worried that it defines you? What do you become afterwards?
Well, I'm trying to sort of safeguard against that now. I try and do loads of different things because I don't want it to be all consuming. I don't want the only thing I am to be an athlete because I can't be that forever.
But yeah, but you have to really, don't you, at this particular stage in your life. If you don't put all your effort into doing that, then you're never going to win the medal. That's the...
Putting all your effort in and letting it be the only thing that defines you, I think, are two different things. Because
okay.
I can be 100% in training. I can make all my decisions based on wanting to win medals and still shut down that side of me. So when I sort of do music, for example, I'm not an athlete at all. Because that's just got nothing to do with it. Yeah, okay. Am I? Yeah, because I can't do gigs that are at 11 p.m. at night because I've got to go home and go to bed. But when I'm, say, writing music, that has nothing to do with me being an athlete. I can shut that down. When I do presenting, yeah, okay, I've probably only really gotten that work because I've been an athlete. But in that exact moment, I'm not an athlete. It doesn't matter how far I can jump right there and then.
I think I first noticed you presenting. I think that's when I first become aware of you, I think. I think I'd seen you do some other stuff, but then did you do some reporting on The Athletic somewhere?
Yeah, I did. This year I did this year just gone, the European Team Championships. I did some finish line stuff at the Great North Run. I've done a few athletics bits with athletics.
Yeah, but because you changed your hair, I suddenly went, oh, okay, that's someone, I thought you were someone new doing And then I started looking you up and stuff, and because I thought you were very good at presenting.
Oh, thanks.
Very natural.
I really
I think
enjoy
that's
it.
That's definitely the key to it. Do you think, because I've spent a lot of time around sports people in my various jobs as a presenter, and I have a laugh with my friend Pete who taught me how to play tennis. I did a tennis initiative thing, and I always say to him, Pete, there's no good comes of sport, because I've seen so many sports people. I'm old enough to have seen them go through all the way through their careers and come to the end. It's such a tough thing that you peak for 5 or 6, 10 years, maybe maximum. And then you spend the rest of your life going, hey, I used to be I used to be a footballer, I used to be a tennis player, I used to be a rugby player, I used to be an athlete or whatever. It's very, very tough that on people, because the highs you can achieve are so phenomenal.
It's just higher than anything else you could.
Yeah.
How are you ever going to replicate that?
Is there anyone... during your process in athletics at all who'd sit with people and go, you know, this is all going to come to an end, and you've literally, unless you're going to be a broadcaster on the BBC, you've got, you know, this career's gone for you.
Not really. There's kind of a life after sport thing, organization, which gets mentioned every now and then. But no, really the focus is all... People remind you how short your career is, but not in a way that says, okay, we'll make sure you've got something to do afterwards. In a way that says, give everything you've got right now, because you've only got a very, very short window to be good at this. And all the focus is on winning and being the absolute best. But I do worry about it sometimes, because your worth is so, so, so derived from whether or not you get these medals. And if you do, great. But the Olympics comes around again in 4 years and suddenly you're not relevant. And would that be hard?
Your worth, though, not anybody else's. People don't judge you, do you think, on your worth? I mean, that's only you judging yourself on that.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you meet people and they'll go, oh, you're an athlete. Okay, have you been to the Olympics? One, this is the first thing. If you haven't been to the Olympics, the interest disappears. So after 2016, I thought, okay, I can finally answer yes to that question. Yes, I went to the Olympics. And then, you know, people, you can see the excitement in their eyes stays there. Oh, did you win a medal? No. Oh. Well, how fast do you run the 100 meters? I don't do the 100 meters. Oh. And all of a sudden they go, well, I can't relate to that anymore. And that's not actually not that interesting. But some people it's not. It's very different. And, you know, having been to the Olympics is a big achievement in itself. But I think suddenly people assume, okay, Olympics, a medal. And then, say I won a bronze this time. And then, oh, what did you win? Oh, no, it was a bronze. Oh. So I don't know if maybe that's me thinking that's how other people view athletes, in that you're only valuable if you win medals. But also you'd if you take a look on Twitter after any competition, you would think that that's also the case. People will tell you how awful you are.
Really, very much
people after the London World Championships, I didn't make it through to the final, and people were so nasty.
What sorts of people?
People without profile pictures.
Do you know what it is, though? I know it doesn't help, but that's about them, not about you. That's about them not having anything in their lives, or actually not having anything in lives. That they've got unhappiness somewhere deep rooted, and the way they can do the outlet is by having a go at someone like you. And if they can hurt you, that makes them feel good. They can bring you down, but you're kind of faceless to them. They don't know you.
Well, exactly. I don't think nobody's ever done that in person. Nobody's ever come up to me and gone, I watched you compete, and you were awful.
Yeah. But what annoys me is when the thing which grates me is when the press or various celebrities, I won't name them again, but I've done it a few times on here because I had an argument with them once, when they start saying, we're rubbish, we're not winning any medals. It's like, when have you ever gone and one of them was a sportsman? I was like, Christ, I've supported you through some really crap stuff. Yeah. And it's like, these guys are trying their hardest. We need to support them, whether they win or lose. It's not all about winning. It's about what effort they've put into it. And I think people just think that, you know, if you're not winning, you're just... You spent all the time in Florida smoking fags or something.
Precisely. I think when you're leading up to the Olympics or any major championships, everyone gets very, very excited for you when you make the team. And it's a huge deal. And it's amazing. But as soon as that championship comes around, they forget that it was amazing a month ago that you made the team. And all of a sudden, that's not even an achievement. That didn't even matter. That's a given.
Yeah.
And now you're here. Where's your medal?
It was 2012, I think, at the Olympics, and we weren't winning medals to begin with.
Yeah, I remember.
And then the press and loads of people going, well, we're rubbish, we're terrible. And then we started winning and we won big. And I was just like, oh, God, all those people were so nasty about it. It was ridiculous.
I get that sport is for entertainment and people want to be entertained, but for you to be entertained, that means somebody has to lose. Mm. So, but that person to even get there was an achievement. So yeah, okay, they've lost, and that's part of sport and how it is, but you can't then say they're terrible. They're not terrible.
Yeah.
Nobody that you're watching on TV is terrible at sport. And I'm pretty sure I can say that across the board. They're better than you.
Yeah, better.
And
definitely.
They're working hard if they've got to the stage where somebody is broadcasting it to the nation.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
So we're filming, what's the date today? 11th, I think it's the 11th, is it?
The 11th.
11th of March, coronavirus is closing down everything. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, are people talking about this yet?
People are talking about Tokyo. Everybody's discussing, are the Olympics going to be cancelled? Are they going to be postponed? Are they going to do it without spectators? Which is what I've heard is the most likely option, because I mean, there's huge stakeholders in the Olympics. It's so big to move or cancel it. That apparently people are thinking about doing it without spectators. The thing is, I have to train as though it's going to be as normal. Nothing can really change for me. We're always super vigilant with stuff anyway, in terms of staying healthy, because if you catch a cold, that could set back your training a week. And a week can mean 10 centimeters, and 10 centimeters can mean not making the Olympics. So we're already super, super on it. Not much has really changed in terms of the way that we're training, because... Well, what would you change? Ideally, you're already doing everything you can do, right? That's the whole point of elite sport, is that you're pushing it to the limits. You're doing absolutely everything you can do to be the best you can be. So we're already doing that. And I don't want anything to be cancelled or changed. I hope everything goes ahead. I think it's really hard to really know how bad it is. We don't know, really.
I told you this just before we started recording, when I met the Brownlee brothers, their people, the Brownlee brothers were great, but their people said, don't shake their hands because we don't want them to get any diseases or anything. And I said, it was fine, you know, it's like fine margins and all that sort of stuff. And the other problem with it is you can't take substances, can you, if you get ill?
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can't take.
You're too scared to do it in case you get drug tested, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can run everything through, if there's a website, you can run everything through to check if it's got anything illegal in it. And then your supplements all have to be batch tested to make sure that, even though the ingredients say that there's nothing in it, just to make sure there actually isn't anything in this batch. So it's things like certain Lemsips you can take, but Lemsip Max, no.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you've got to be really careful. Anything you take for any illness, you have to run through this website to see if it's fine.
So are you making any changes at the moment because the Olympics come up, like not shaking people's hands or something?
Not really. No. I mean, I always carry hand sanitizer with me anyway. I wash my hands a lot. Yeah, always. Whenever I get on a train or a plane, I clean my area.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because travel...
You look like a lunatic.
Yeah, you do look like a lunatic with your little anti-bac wipes. You do. Not on a train always. I always hand sanitize when I get on a train and when I'm about to touch anything. But on a plane, I always clean my area. Because people think it's the air that's the problem on a plane. It's not. It's the area that you're in that's not cleaned that well. Your chair and everything. How many people have sat in that in the last... You don't know how dirty those people are. Kids will have sat in it. Kids sneeze on everything nonstop.
Yeah.
I feel like. And so you don't know where everything's... But so yeah, I clean my areas... when I'm traveling anyway. So that's pretty normal.
Let's talk about your singing.
Okay.
Because you went on The Voice.
Yes.
Brave thing to do. Brave. That's brave for firemen, aren't they? Not brave. Yeah. But that's an interesting choice. You were brilliant on it, but nice. You got chosen by will.i.am.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Then we got to the battle stages and I lost the battle.
What do you make of will.i.am?
He's a character, right?
Did you get to spend much time with him?
No. None? None.
What, they're supposed to be your mentor?
He was not our mentor. I mean, it's been years now, so I'm well out of the contract, so you can say everything. No, you don't see him at all. He turns up however long into the session that we're doing, gets given his lines of what he's supposed to say to us, and then he goes.
No,
yeah.
I've interviewed him a couple of times. I really like him. I think he's an amazing man.
I didn't get to know him enough to like or not dislike him, which was a shame.
We were doing tarantula burgers on my show that week, and he's
what?
Yeah, we were doing tarantula burgers, and he said I ain't going to eat no tarantula burger. That's what I remember. I remember it vividly, remember it. I ain't going to eat no tarantula burger. So he wouldn't do that. But he was great. Every time I interview him, I say, "What's it like living in the future?" Well, I am, because he loves all his gadgets and stuff, doesn't he? Like that. I'm disappointed he wasn't. He didn't help you.
I think that was the experience for most people on The Voice. I think. There was one judge that year, Gavin, used to be in Bush, used to be married to Gwen Stefani.
Yeah, Gavin
Rossdale.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, he apparently was very, very involved with his group.
Right.
And would stay in contact with them often and was great. But no,
should you have won your battle?
I don't know.
What would have happened? Would you have liked to have gone all the way to... Obviously, you like winning, don't you? So it's a bit of a stupid question to ask.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to keep going, but... A lot of people in athletics told me it was a good thing because it meant I could have an indoor season.
Right. But no one off The Voice ever goes on to do anything, do they?
Nobody off The Voice has ever been like super successful, I don't think. Not in the UK anyway.
So what do you want to do with singing? Are you gonna do that when you retire from athletics?
Yeah, I hope so.
You're very good, by the way. If you want to see, she does stuff all over her Instagram account. Yes. Jasmine does stuff.
It's on Instagram and YouTube.
She is sitting here.
My name, it's there.
Yeah, you're good. How long have you been doing this for?
Well, I used to do musical theatre when I was a kid, and I loved that. I loved all the singing and the acting and but the singing especially.
Your parents are great.
Oh, they're amazing.
They've taken you there in athletics.
I don't know how they managed. It's nuts. I've got two little brothers that were equally as busy, so I don't know how.
Wow.
The family helped a lot. We were nuts. I mean, I think we had a lot of energy, and they were like, can you put that energy on someone else? We're at home. We want to breathe. So I got into it basically through musical theatre. Stopped doing that when I was about 13, 14, because I got my first international and my first athletics international clashed with a dress rehearsal for a competition. I thought, okay, this isn't going to work. I need to pick one, pick sport. And then when I came to uni, I decided I kind of wanted to do a little bit more music because I found myself with so much free time between once the semester was over at uni. I was just training and then I had nothing else to do. And there was a charity shop near where I lived and they changed the display every couple of weeks and they had a big display of musical instruments. I thought, that's fun. I'll get a guitar and learn to play acoustic guitar just because it's fun. And that ended up being, I had a friend who used to run music nights, sort of variety nights in London. I was living in Sheffield at the time. And he said, look, come down and see me. And he'd book me into a gig. And I just started playing, singing. And he was like, why don't you try and write? So I started writing a little bit. And then The Voice picked up my YouTube videos from when I started putting things on and said, do you want to come and audition? And I said, I can't because I'm training for the Olympics and I'm trying to finish my degree. And they said, all right, well, do you want to come back next year? And so that's how I ended up on The Voice.
Wow.
Because they didn't know about that sport at the time. They'd just seen my YouTube videos. And then when I told them about the sport, they were like, yeah, come on, that's a story.
So you're writing your own stuff?
Yeah, with my brother. My little brother, he's not sort of in music in terms of as a career, but he's... so much more musical than me. He's gifted with music, my little brother, really, my middle brother. And so I write for him. I haven't released anything, partly because I don't really know how, and partly because we just kind of mess around. But I love it. I haven't done that much this year because I'm trying to keep the focus on athletics. And if you want a gig, you have to stay out late, generally. And I just can't. I need to sleep. So it tends to stay in my room. But I love it. Every year I get asked to do a few things and I say yes to as much music as I can. It's so fun.
Where are you from?
Stoke.
The lottery funding's been brilliant, really, hasn't it, for athletics? Because for them to actually come to your school, is that what happened?
People no,
come,
so...
I thought you said people came to your school looking for
that
talent.
That was bobsleigh. So British bobsleigh. That's when... So I'm from Stoke. I was in Stoke until I was 16. And then I applied for a scholarship to Millfield in Somerset so that I could train full-time because they've got a track. They've got coaches that are just coaches and not teachers. And I wanted to up my training because my coaches in Stoke had full-time jobs and they couldn't train more than I was. And I was thinking, I want to do this with my life. So I applied for a scholarship to go there, went there for sixth form, and because that's such a sporty school, British bobsleigh just went to a few schools in the country. It was British bobsleigh rather than sort of lottery funding that was specifically looking for athletes. But that said, lottery funding has been amazing. Lottery funding was what funded when I was living in Bath. That it was a lottery funded facility. I've been on lottery funding since 2013.
Yeah, it's an experiment that's worked because, you see lots of things come and go. Other countries have tried to buy athletes, by the way, and buy success.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them have done it by using illegal substances, as we all know. But ours has actually worked, and I think it's great. The amount of success, the amount of medals we get now at tournaments, and it's great for the country. It really lifts us all up, doesn't it? And
of course. I mean, we say it's not all about the winning, but it's great when we do win. I mean, people get very, very invested in it, and I think people really feel like they've been a part of something. That's what I love about lottery funding as well, is that you can, we turn around and say, if you've bought a lottery ticket, this is your medal too.
All right.
You've been a part of this.
The drug thing doesn't go away, does it, ever?
No. It's depressing. I think when I'm finished with sport, I'll try and do something. But at the minute, there's nothing I can do. I just have to compete. I just have to be clean and compete. Because I can't change anything right now in where I'm at. I don't think I can dedicate enough time to it. Because I think it's going to require a lot of time, a lot of effort. I don't think it's going to be miserable.
It's Kelly Sutherton the other day who got... Didn't she go from something like not medaling to bronze to silver or something? I mean, I can't really remember this.
Sort of 8 or so years ago. So Kelly...
Yeah, so it's so many years ago. She's such a lovely woman. And yet she didn't get the chance to win her medal on TV like the rest of them.
Kelly came home from the 2008 Olympics in Beijing with no medals. 2 fourth places. 8 years later, she got 2 bronze medals. Imagine the difference in her life leading into a home Olympics. She'd have come home a double medalist and she came home with nothing because of drug cheats. That's not just taking your moment on the podium. That is a livelihood there. The kind of opportunities you get in this country as an Olympic medalist are crazy. Coming home from an Olympics with 2 medals leading into a home games, I'm sure it pains her a lot more. It pains me to think what she missed out on because of the drug cheats. It's
hasn't one of the bronze now been upgraded to a silver? I might have made that up.
Kelly's. But I know that somebody... I thought Jenny Meadows just got a silver. I don't know if
Kelly
got upgraded again.
I'm not sure either. It's absolutely nuts, isn't it? And what frustrates me is they get a short ban and then, or whatever size length ban, and then they're allowed to come back and compete.
Yeah,
and I think it should just be...
I'm sorry, if you get caught...
Life ban.
Yeah, it should be a life ban. I agree. But... I feel like, I don't know if we're doing enough, if WADA are doing enough. I know that UCAD want to be doing something. I don't know if you've seen, they've banned a hammer thrower, Mark Dry, for 4 years. He's never failed a drug test. He lied about his whereabouts because he forgot to change them, said he was somewhere else. Within, I think, an hour, fessed up, said, look, sorry, I wasn't where I said I was supposed to be, but I'm here, this is where I am. Which isn't, he's in the testing pool that's not even supposed to get a barrier ban for missing tests.
One test.
They gave him a 4-year ban. And that feels like they're just trying to be seen to be doing something because they know that drugs are an issue. But don't go after this guy who's never failed a test, who you didn't even, you know, who missed a... If I miss a test today, if I say that I'm supposed to be... If I say that I'm at home in Stoke and I'm actually here and they go to Stoke and I say, oops, sorry, I forgot to change my whereabouts, there aren't any immediate consequences for that. That's what's happened with Mark Dryan. They've given him a 4-year ban.
Can he appeal?
No, he's run out of appeals. He appealed once, won, then they overturned it. And yet we have convicted drug cheats back in our sport. To me, that makes no sense. None. There are people that have failed tests that are getting 2-year bans.
And it's tough for us as the spectators to buy into it sometimes.
Of course,
then, isn't it?
I understand that. You look and you go, well, it's full of cheats. And you see it all the time on Twitter. There will be a piece of news about athletics and they are full of cheats. And I get why they say that. It's not. Not everybody's cheating. Some people are cheating. And, you know, some of us in the sport have an idea of who we think it is. But not everybody is. Some of us are just working really hard. And, you know, some of us are making it, some of us aren't. But I get that for somebody just watching, how do you know what's legitimate?
Well, always the worst one with this was Lance Armstrong, because we all bought into him, didn't we? And we, because of the cancer and his charity, and we were all wearing our yellow wristbands. And everyone loved him, and he was kept on, and everyone was going, leave the guy alone. He's tested negative so many times. And then, wow, like, what a narcissist, what a horrible man he turns out to be. Yet people still sort of like him, don't they? I find it quite horrific what he did, actually.
Me too.
Because everybody bought into him, so in
Me
such
too.
A
and the way that people turn around and go, well, everyone was doing it. I'm sorry, that doesn't cut it for me. When it all costs doesn't extend to that, to me. Really doesn't.
There's always that image in my mind, because obviously I watched documentaries on it and read lots about it, where they're sitting there with their blood on a wall and they're trying to change their blood when they might be thinking, I'm not sure this is legal, you know? I'm not sure we should be doing this. That's the bit. And it's kind
really
of
really not hard to not take drugs, you know.
Bullying and everything else. What do you do about diet? I mean, I see you cook quite a bit.
Yeah,
so
I like
you like your food. Mm-hmm. Does diet help you in the long jump?
Yeah, it unfortunately is really important. If I could just train all day instead and eat what I wanted, I would so take that option. But diet is so important. With long jump, it's ultimately power to weight ratio. If you're carrying fat that you don't need to be carrying, you have to try and drag that through the air. You've got to take off with that. That's like, I'll throw you a dumbbell and go run with that. It's just dead weight. So I've got to, you know, I'm only 5'3". My kind of total daily energy expenditure isn't very much, even with training. So I have to try and keep my weight down. And that means choosing really healthy choices when the season comes around. I can't maintain my competition weight all year. One, I'm miserable. I'm such a horrible person when I'm hungry. I'm just no fun to be around at all. And I get injured and ill at my competition weight.
But you're always eating ice cream.
I'm always eating low calorie ice cream. My coach said the exact same thing as you. I posted it on, I did a full day of eating on my Instagram stories. And the first thing my coach said to me next morning was like, oh, ice cream is it? We're eating ice cream every day. And I'm like, come on. If this is the worst thing in my diet, if a bit of low calorie ice cream is the worst bit in my diet all day, then coach, you got nothing to worry about. But years gone by, it's been awful. You know, I got such a sweet tooth in a huge way. And in a way that, like, I don't stop to feel sick at any point. I used to just, you know how cream eggs sometimes are 3 for £1? I'd go in and buy 6, sit in my car, eat 6 and be like, that wasn't enough. I'm going to buy 3 more and eat them. And then
wow.
Yeah. That's sweet. So we're fighting that off every day. But I do love cooking. So that's one nice thing, is that if I can spend, I'll happily spend an hour and a half making myself a nice meal.
Yeah.
So,
do you think when you finish your career, you could be able to help people with that side of things? Is there a...
Yeah, I've thought about that and maybe getting some actual qualifications, because all I know is what works for me.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily what's quote unquote the right thing to do. I mean, I don't think I'm far off what's good. You know, eat a lot of vegetables, get your protein in, get your fats from the right sources. It's pretty straightforward. Mm. Avoid too many processed foods. I think do that and you'll struggle to go too far wrong.
Mm.
Whatever kind of diet you want to follow, whether that's, you know, a vegetarian vegan diet, or whether you want to be paleo or whatever you want, if you kind of fit around those rules, quote unquote, you can't go too far wrong. I don't know if I would go into it, because it can be quite sensitive, diet in sport. I think because especially with something like long jump and a lot of sports that are similar, that are power to weight ratio sports, often people look at you first thing and go, just lose some weight. And that can very quickly go wrong in sport and become eating disorders, and people can become obsessed with it and they can think that's the only thing that can affect their performance. The problem is sometimes it is. Sometimes all you need to do is lose a bit of weight, but that's not always the answer. And I think people jump straight to that. In sport, people would often jump straight to that with me. Because I'm shorter for a long jumper, I can't be this long, thin thing, because I have no power. I don't know what, you know, if you're really tall, you've got range in your limbs to work with. I do not have that. So I got to have some power. So there's always going to be more to me. I'm going to be more built than a lot of the long jumpers that you see. And so a lot of people straight away go, just lose some weight, you'll jump further. And like, that's not necessarily the answer. But sometimes...
Well, how tall are the girl competitors then?
So some of them, it ranges from... You know, I mean, there's a few of us, I'm 5'3", there's a few of us that are under 5'6", but the majority are going to be 5'8", 5'9", 5'11", 6'1", 6'2", 6'3".
What?
Yeah. You should see me in a lineup. If you watch the athletics and you have a look at the lineup, it kind of, you see this dip where I'm standing. Sometimes I'll be on a podium and I'll be on in second and it looks like I'm in third.
Oh my God, that's nuts.
Yeah. Some of these girls are tall.
So what do you think the ideal height is for long jump?
Well, I really struggle with that, because I think the average height is taller. I don't know about ideal, because the current Olympic champion is 5'5".
Right.
But it's because she's super, super fast. Tiana Bartoletta, she's like, I think she's a 10-7 100 meter runner at her best. She's just super, super, super fast.
So how's your training going for...
Really well, thanks. Yeah, it's been good. I mean, this time, the past 2 years, I've had an injury over winter and I haven't this year.
Mm.
And it seems to have made a massive difference. I've been really inconsistent on the board. I did 2 competitions indoors. Normally I do 5 or 6. I just did 2 this year because the World Indoors got cancelled because of coronavirus. So I just did 2. And I jumped further than I have since 2017. But I also, in 12 jumps, had 8 fouls. And I think that's because...
Too many?
That's much too many. I'm getting it right only a fraction of the time. But when I'm getting it right, it's good. So, you know, I'm looking at some of these fouls and I'm going really far, but it doesn't count. So I just need to fine-tune my consistency for the outdoor season.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can jump as far as you want. If you're over the Pleistocene, nobody cares. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I was listening to a basketball talk the other day, and I think it might have been Charles Barkley who said that. His coach said to him, you're no good, blah, blah, blah. And he said, no, I am good. And he goes, you're not working hard enough and smart enough. And then eventually this coach took him and turned him into the, you know, supreme basketball athlete he was. But he said, I look at all these kids who say they're great at basketball, but there's so many elements to being a successful athlete. Mm-hmm. And he says, you can never forget what's in the mind is one of the most important things. And that must be so hard. Like in a team sport, like, I don't know, football or basketball, you can come and go in the game, you know.
Yeah,
you've got to deliver every time you hit that run up, don't you, really? Mm-hmm. Or every competition.
Or at least in the first 3 jumps. You've got to at least find one in those first 3 that's good enough.
Yeah.
It's
a mentally tough sport.
I think so. Yeah, especially when there are some athletes that I know that what I need to do, you'd think there's no tactics in long jump. I mean, there aren't tactics, but there are certain things that can help you out. You know, you look at an 800 meter race and there's tactics in that. There are some athletes that I know, if I come past them early in the competition, they won't come past me again because it messes with them in their head. Some people look at me and go, you're not a long jumper. And it bothers them when I beat them.
Right.
And I can see that.
I want to get onto our questions to ask everyone, but just quickly, the mind games. I think it was Mark Foster who told me that because I talked to him about the swimming and the mind games, and he said, well, there's a bit, but he said, you know, the guys who are really focused with the headphones and stuff,
yeah.
He said he sometimes walks up to them and go, hi, how you doing? And so to try and break the zone and stuff like that. Are there mind games in long jump?
You know, I haven't really seen much of it. Long jump's super friendly. We can't take electronics out to the field of play, so there's no sort of headphones or anything like that. But I've never really seen it. I've heard about it. I've heard of people moving each other's markers on the runway.
Wow.
Or accidentally kicking them over, quote unquote. I did actually accidentally kick someone's over the other day. I felt so bad. But I've heard about that happening on purpose. I've never really seen it. I mean, some people can be, you know, they'll make sure to bring up a time that you've done badly or talk about your injuries right there and then. Some people will try and hide their injuries. Some people will try and show them off. Like some people will tape up when I know they don't need tape,
right,
because they want you to think that they're injured. There's a little bit, but on the whole, I found long jump a really friendly event. I think my philosophy with athletics is the longer that you have to spend with your competitors, the friendlier you are. So the sprinters are all seem to be quite, so they butt heads quite a lot, but they're only out there for 10 minutes while they set the blocks up and then they run for 9 seconds. We're out there for an hour and a half together. The combined eventers are all best buddies because they're there for 2 days together. So I really do think the longer you have to spend in neutral with your competitors, so where you're not actually competing, which, you know, for the combined eventers, they have, the men have 10 events and they have a room that they sleep in the stadium together. So they're around each other for 2 days nonstop.
My favorite with the sort of sledging type thing is Eric Bristow, apparently years ago. Eric Bristow, who's a darts player, years ago used to go to his opponents. When about to throw, sometimes he'd say to them, do you hold your breath or breathe out or breathe in when you're about to throw? Something you never think about. And suddenly you're going, what do I do? I don't know what I do. I don't know what I do. And it's just that those little things where it just changes.
That's
them.
A good tip.
Yeah, maybe you could do that. Right, let me ask you the questions that I ask everyone. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
So this is something that came from a sports psych that I used to work with. And it was when I'm either nervous or feeling bad about a competition, I used to just try and push that away. Just, you know, don't, you know, feel good. No, accept that. Let it in. Feel that for a second. Give yourself a minute or however long you want to actually really feel that bad feeling. It's all right. It's going to come. And if you push it away, it's going to bomb you. That was what the sports psych said. Ashley Bryant, who is a British decathlete, gave a team talk at one of our competitions, and he said, as a decathlete, you're going to have bad events. You have to be able to overcome that, but you can't just push away the feeling that you're annoyed about this bad event. So he goes, I give myself a set time, sometimes a set timer, and go, you got 5 minutes to be annoyed about this.
Mm.
Go, feel it. Let it all in, soak it in, feel that horrible feeling, and then move on.
And that's a good tip for life. I've only realized this later on in my life, but feelings are temporary. How you feel now, you're never going to feel like in an hour's time, 2 hours' time, definitely a year's time.
Yep.
So even if you're coming out of losing your job or a breakup with somebody, the feelings are temporary. That's good. How much time do you spend with sports psychs?
Recently, not so much, but I've just started working with a new one. I think it's really important. Not that there's anything wrong, but by the time you get out to the field of play, everyone is almost as good as each other. It's a few centimeters that'll separate gold and eighth place. So really, it's about on the day, who's going to hold their nerve the best, who can actually perform, who can be as good as they actually are on the day, and that's all in your head. So I've finally found somebody that really works well with me, and I'll be doing that. I'll be sort of actually in a call with them at least once a week.
So are there any tips? Or don't you want to give it away?
No, it's very early doors with this new person, so I'm not sure. It's not even necessarily giving it away. I think it's very, very individualized.
Are you confident? You seem really confident to me.
I am confident, and I like competing. I get excited. I only get nervous for about 20 minutes usually, and it happens in the call room when we're all sort of penned in. And we've got about 40 minutes until we compete, and everyone's sat right there, and I'm like, oh my God,
that's the thing I always don't get about the people when they talk about football. They're going, stop putting pressure on our young kids or something. It's like, but that's what they want.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, even the level of football I played at, you know, if ever I played in a cup competition or the rare times I played where there was people watching, I'd be like, brilliant, they can watch me play because I'm all right at
this. Exactly, I love a full stadium.
I played golf with Ian Poulter once, like a pro-am thing, I got there because I'm crap at golf, and I absolutely topped my first drive, and excuse my language, but I shit myself, and I was like, this is terrible. And I said, do you never get nervous? He goes, no, I like showing off how good I am to these people.
That's exactly how it feels. It's the minute I walk out is when the nerves go. I've got all these people have come to watch me.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me show you what I can do. Let me put on a show for you.
Let me get you clapping. This
That's exactly it. That's why I like to sing as well. It's like, yeah, you've come to watch me. Enjoy. I will entertain you. Yeah.
Brilliant. What's something you think people should know?
So from all the traveling around competing, I think people should know a little bit of conversation in whatever language of wherever you're going to. It will make so much difference. People will be so much more willing to help you if you just try. Maybe not absolutely everywhere in France. They don't want you just trying to speak French because you're terrible. but I think pretty much everywhere else. I learned that really when I went to Barcelona for the World Junior Champs in 2012. And I got chatting to the bus driver in Spanish because I was studying it at the time. And I've never, ever, ever has a bus driver been so helpful to me. He took me to a different training track that I wasn't supposed to go to. And, you know, my Spanish wasn't great, but it was making the effort.
Do you still speak Spanish now?
I speak a little. I like watching programs where they speak Spanish so I can kind of keep it up.
Do you?
Yeah.
Wow, you're really interesting. Right, is there something you've changed your mind about?
Yes, this is completely separate to everything we've been talking about.
Yeah.
But fast fashion. I used to always want to get the best deal, the cheapest possible deal on the clothes that I was buying. And I think there's been a lot more conversation recently about, well, why is that so cheap? Who made that? What did they get paid to make it? And I'd never really had that consideration with things before. And yeah, there's the whole thing about, okay, well, if it's more quality, it'll last long, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But really, there are people making these clothes. And why is it a pound for a bikini? Nobody's been paid fairly to make that, if that's the case. And what impact is my choices on getting a very cheap piece of clothing having on somebody way down the line that I'll never see and I'll never know. But I've very much changed my approach to that and tried not to buy into that so much.
I can't agree with you more. I'm going to be slightly sexist here, but I used to go shopping with my twin daughters and they hated it after a while because it used to make me so depressed going to women's clothes shop in the sort of high street cheaper range and just watching the way the clothes are thrown on the floor and they're just and people going, you could hear the conversations, I'll just buy these three and I'll bring two back or something, or you know, and it's like you're looking through the prices of them and I was like, no one cares about any of these clothes.
Yes.
And I find that quite weird.
It is, we're so disconnected from what that actually is. What it's taken for this piece of clothing to turn up in this shop, we're so far away from that. And I think it would be good for a lot of us and me more recently to remember and to try and think about how it got there and what the process was and what the impact is. Then are you going to buy it and wear it once? Where's it then going to end up? What's the journey that this piece of clothing has been on? And
I wonder what impact that has on fashion. Cause I love clothes. I dress conservatively now, but it's like, I like buying a nice item of clothing or something. It's really nice. And I like looking at people and I like fashion. I like all that sort of stuff. But I wonder where it goes if it's not fast fashion. Do you think you could hold on to something for more than two seasons?
Yes, for some things. What's going on a lot at the minute is there's a big rise in clothing rental companies. So where you just rent it for either events or even just for everyday wear, but sort of high quality items.
Is it Tiffany Haddish who bought a dress said, and they said to her, she went to a premiere and they went to another premiere in it and they went, you're wearing the same dress? She goes, yeah, I bought it and I really like it, so I want to wear it. So I think she wore it for the whole of a year
that
or something.
Which is great. You know, I think with especially celebrities, if you're going to be buying a new dress for each event, gosh, that's a waste. And you've seen it again.
I was on Sedge Beswick's podcast the other day, who deals with all the influencers and things like that. And we were discussing that rental clothes thing. And I used to play Dragon's Den with my daughter, still do every now and then. And one of my ideas was rent a life, where basically you get everything given to you. And part of that, then one of them emailed me once with a link to that rent a fashion thing. She said, it's starting to come true, Dad. And it's like, yeah, why not? Why not rent clothes?
Exactly, why not? I mean, I don't think fashion needs to go away. People are always going to want to look good and express themselves through fashion, but we need to find a way to do it a bit better. It's not sustainable the way that we're doing it.
Though then are we taking livings away from the people who are making the clothes?
Or are we demanding that...
we pay them.
That we pay them. I don't know the answer to that. You know, if
It feels wrong, though. It feels wrong.
It feels wrong.
It feels wrong to wear something once.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And I think now back to when I was sort of maybe a fresher in uni, you'd buy a costume for something.
Yeah.
And I think, God, what a huge waste. How ridiculous. And
oh, God,
you know,
can I say this? I'm World Book Day. There's a lot of people buying things for their kids, which they'll grow out of.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like... I look at all the kids in their outfits, and a lot of people are hiring them or buying them offline and stuff like that. And I always think that's going to be worn once. It's
that really is an example, isn't it? The kid's too big for it next year, and you're not going to wear the same costume again.
But then it's quite a nice thing when all the kids dress up.
There's got to be a better way.
Mm. I always say to everyone, don't buy the green suit, because if you buy the green suit and you wear the green suit more than once, you're the guy basically known as the guy in the green suit. So So make sure when you buy clothes, even though you think I look good in the green suit, don't buy the green suit. Anyway, that's just my theory on clothes.
Well, I did walk in a giant silver coat, and I wear the silver coat all
the
time.
The silver
coat.
Silver coat is something
else. I am the girl in the silver coat.
Yeah, you look like an astronaut. Is there something you've changed your mind about?
That was this.
Oh, that was that. Any life hacks?
Yes. Travel life hack.
Good.
It's to do with the big coat, actually. It only really works if you're either going to or coming from somewhere cold. But the big coat, pillowcase in the pocket, take the pillowcase out, stuff the big coat in the pillowcase, you have a travel pillow.
What a brilliant idea. That's the best one we've ever had.
Yes.
I can really relate to that. That's brilliant. What a great idea.
Thank you. The normal travel pillows are annoying to have with you, because then once you're at your destination, you don't want that.
That's such a good idea.
Thanks. I was talking to my friend about this last night. I said, I've got to come up with a hack. And she was like, you must have something, a travel hack. She said, what do you do when you're traveling? And I said that. She was like, you have to say that.
That's brilliant. That's the best one ever. Can you recommend a book? I know you like reading.
Yes.
So
my favorite book is called Born on a Blue Day by Daniel Tammet. And it's an autobiography. And Daniel Tammet is a math savant and a language savant. So he can recite pi to like 30,000 decimal places just by reading off the landscape in his head. He can just see it. He just knows what it is. It's something works in his brain with maths where he just sees it. So when every number has a shape and a color, days have colors, so have synesthesia as well. And so you ask it, you tell him to do a sum, and it's not that he works it out. It's that like, the shape for 7 and the shape for 229 just come together. And also the languages is what fascinates me more. He learned Icelandic in a week. And went on Icelandic TV and gave an interview after a week learning Icelandic. It's fascinating.
What is it called?
Born on a Blue Day. Because I think something Tuesday is, I think, a blue to him. So that's it's.
But our brains can't do this.
No, they can't. No, we can't learn this. But it's fascinating. I've read it a few times.
Do you know the book I'd really like you to read? And I was trying to get it for you, but it's Megan Hine, Mind of a Survivor. But they seem to have gone out of print now. But she came on this podcast.
Oh, I'll find it.
And this book, I think you'd really, it'd resonate with you, because she's like you, really excited about life. And it changed my life, her book. It really did. And I know I always say that.
I think she thinks
I'm a bit weird because I always talk about how good the book is, but it's just like, she's a survival expert, you know, an adventurer person. You read it and you just go, wow, she sees the world in such an exciting way. But also her acceptance of life is just fantastic. And I think you'd really enjoy it. But you'll enjoy the book I bought you anyway, hopefully.
Thanks.
I'm going to ask you one more question before I get to the final question, because I ask people this quite often. What's it like being famous? You're obviously famous in the athletics world.
Yeah, I'm only really famous in the athletics world. So it's very occasionally somebody will come up to me in normal life and say, oh, you know, I saw you in this and I thought, well done in this jump. That doesn't really happen. So I'm not famous in sort of the normal world at all. But then when you go to athletics, it's intense. And I think for some people, they don't expect it at all, because there aren't that many massive athletics fans. The people who really are athletics fans are there at every competition. They're always there, and you get to know people because it's the same crowd over and over again. I love it. I really, really, really love it, because it really feels like there are people that appreciate and respect the work that I've put in. And these are people that they follow what I'm doing online on social media. It feels like they like me. And, you know, everybody wants to be liked, right? It's not just when I do well. People, you know, I'll see the same people at the competitions all the time, and I feel like they like me. So I want to see them. You know, I'll go to a competition and think, oh, I'm looking forward to seeing James or to seeing Ash. I know these people. Obviously, there's the same. It's nice with the kids because the kids always want autographs and pictures, and you feel very special and very like what you're doing is sort of worthwhile in a way. But honestly, I love it. I think it's really, it's nice that it's contained into athletics because I don't think I'd love it all the time. I don't think I would want.
When it crossed over to The Voice, because there was obviously articles written about you and stuff, did you enjoy that side of it as well?
Yeah, because it was only for a short time. And then I was getting recognised, and that was, again, I felt very, oh, me, really? It was cool. I don't think I would think it was cool if it was every day and all the time. But to get that sort of little glimpse into what it would be like to actually be famous, I think everybody would like the glimpse. I don't think almost anybody would like the full time. Mm. I don't think I would want, I know I wouldn't want that kind of full time fame. Like, I think now about Dina. Dina's like famous now. She's like legitimately famous.
She's got her own little doll now.
She's got her own doll. Dina Asher Smith Barbie doll. You know, you're famous, Dina.
Yeah.
So I don't, and you know, I don't go out with her outside of athletics that often, but I can imagine she's getting stopped all the time.
Yeah.
I don't think I would like that because you just want to be able to do everything.
I don't know Dina at all, but you're very outgoing, your personality. I'm not sure, I've not heard Dina talk as much. So
she is outgoing, is she? As well. Yeah, I don't know if she is so much in interviews. I don't know if you get the full impression, but she really is. She's really fun.
She sounds really fun, but yeah.
Maybe she's not quite as, I am quite outgoing.
Yeah. Well, you've 100% got a career in broadcasting if you want to do it when you finish. So that's a good thing. Right, first, last question is, what is the meaning of life?
Well, I am convinced that there isn't one. But that is great news. That is great news because it means you can do whatever you want. If you're not trying to achieve anything in particular.
You're saying sin. Is that what you're saying?
Sin? What's sin?
Well, I don't know. It could be immoral. Can you be?
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why
the drug treats?
I mean, you can do whatever you want, can't you? There's consequences, I suppose. Do I want to pick a meaning of life to have the most fun you can without hurting anybody else?
That's the meaning of life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if
I think you need to work on this one. Go.
Yeah.
You need to.
I don't.
No, you need to go away and read.
Oh, okay. I'll read the book you gave me and come back to you.
Yeah, find out.
There you go, yeah. You should have cut it there. Don't post this bit.
You need to find a meaning of life. It's important. Well, no, you don't at all. But I just wanted you to have a better answer.
Sorry. We'll end on a disappointing note, shall we?
Jasmine, it's been absolutely fantastic. Best of luck with the rest of the season.
Thank you.
I hope the Olympics happens.
Me too, honestly.
Yeah. So, best of luck with that. And thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
Pleasure. That's Jasmine Sawyer there. I thoroughly enjoyed that. She's a lovely person, isn't she?
I wish we could have done a couple of parts of that and spread that over a few weeks. That was such good fun.
What I found fascinating is when people do things like long jump is how much there is in it.
It's amazing talking to her, the centimetres, the millimetres,
yeah.
the wrong step, what's it called? Fine margins.
Yeah. What I think's great about her though is she's very natural. She's not. You know, I think a lot of sportsmen come up with the right things to say. Sportsmen and women come up with the right things to say, like the hype, the answer they're supposed to do. And she doesn't. She's just telling it truthfully about what it's like to do it. And it's such a lovely insight into that world. And, you know, she desperately wants to win, which is great.
I think what's brilliant about her and what's brilliant about the athletes and the sports people you really like is that it's not the only thing in her world. She cares about it and she loves it. But she's into cooking, she's into music, and it was really funny. We were just saying, you know, she said, "Oh yeah, when I was doing my degree, and I speak Spanish, and I cook." And you're like, "Where'd you get the time to do all this stuff? And you were training, and you did The Voice. I mean, doing The Voice for one person is like the only thing they do.
Yeah,
or does everything. Amazing. Yeah."
She's very much focused on living, isn't she?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And what I love about athletics and. I've been talking about this to people for a while now. You need a backstory. It's whether you like it or not, sport, the best sport on TV has that X factor. What's the backstory?
It's an element of personality.
Yeah, and so she's got a great story, where she's from, you know, and everything about her, and the fact that she does the singing and everything else. But anyway, like, I thoroughly enjoyed her company. I thought she was great, and I really hope the Olympics happens for all those athletes. In some way, it seems like it might end up.
By the time between us recording this and it going out, it might even not be a thing. Just day by day, isn't it, at the moment, with everything, I'm afraid.
Fingers crossed for all those people who've spent so long training. Anyway, this podcast is sponsored by Cooker. It's spelt quicker and pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It does hot water. It does cold water, which is your normal sort of water. It does 100 degree boiling hot water. It does chilled filtered water, and it does chilled sparkling filtered water.
Woo-hoo!
I absolutely love it. Do you know what? Should we tell them what Jasmine drank? When she came over, she wasn't drunk. What she drank.
She drank.
Where's the word? What she drunk or drank? I don't know. What she drank was just hot water.
Hot water from?
Obviously, Cooker.
Because it's filtered, boiling. Yeah, just boiling water.
Boiling hot water.
It's that weird thing. You know, when someone comes to your house, or, you know, you're entertaining or whatever, and someone wants something so simple, you feel like you haven't given them enough hospitality. Do you know what I mean? What do you like? Could I make you something?
Have some nuts.
Have some nuts. Have something.
Have an orange.
I just want water. You're like, now I can't host you.
Well, yeah, I spent a few quid on heating it up. Electricity, though, I will say with Cooker, the way it's done is heated the water, because people say, oh, isn't it really expensive and bad for the environment keeping the water hot all the time? Well, it works in a vacuum type scenario. I don't know how it works, but it does work with a vacuum.
It does work.
It does work with a vacuum.
We know this much. It does work.
And we also know that it's more environmentally friendly, because it heats the water up and then it keeps it hot for a very long period of time, and it doesn't keep on reheating it. Apparently, that's how it works, because it works in a vacuum. Also, I thought Jasmine's comments...
You're going to just keep repeating the word vacuum, because that's the only bit you can remember.
Yeah, that's the only bit I know, yeah. Also, I thought the other thing Jasmine said, which is interesting, is the thing about fast fashion.
Yeah.
I've noticed with my twin daughters, they're 18 now. I think a lot of people know they're around that age. They're not into fast fashion anymore, and it's become very uncool.
Have they gone into the thing of charity shops?
It's all thrift stop stuff. They buy some new stuff, but they buy a lot of thrift. And then every now and then you can see them, because fast fashion is such a thing, you can see their eyes light up as they walk past, I don't know, Urban Outfitters or Topshop or something. But then they seem to think it's cooler to be recycling and stuff like that. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but it's interesting because people are talking about it.
I was when Jasmine was talking about it, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, I get so much wear out of my clothes. There should be a guilt. I don't get the guilt, because I wear, you know, you were talking about, can you wear it for two seasons? I'm thinking, some of the t-shirts I wear, I've had since I've honestly had since about 20 years.
Well, that's it. If you learn anything from this podcast, it's buy things which are basic colours as well.
Oh, yeah.
Don't be the guy in the green suit.
Green suit. That's brilliant. The only day you can pull that out is St. Patrick's Day.
That's it from this week's podcast. We'll be back very soon. For the time being, peace and love, joy.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Mark Augustin. If you would like to contact us, then our email address is dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Or Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.